Welcome to this year's Corbett Lecture. Samuel Sterndale Corbett was a Christ man who lived from 1878 to 1951. We don't know a great deal about him, other than that we have a copy of his Last Will and Testament, and he left it that the residue of his estate, after furniture and personal effects and food expenses, should be held in trust and the income paid as long as she lives to Gladys May Whitbread, who is obviously his housekeeper. On her death, the trust has become the absolute property of the University of Cambridge, of which I am a graduate. And I hope the authorities of the university may see their way to found therewith an annual prize for proficiency in classical Greek, to be awarded on such conditions as they think best. An admirable benefactor. He died in 1951. Miss Whitbread didn't die until 1982, and so it was only in the early 80s that the Corbett Prize was instituted. We've established a prize for the person, the student, who'd made most progress in intensive Greek from their admission to the university to taking part one, or part 1B as we now call it. But the university treasurer at the time advised that the faculty, in his view, or the university, could use the money or part of it for a purpose other than an annual prize if it wished. So we went with the annual prize, but we also thought a lectureship would be an appropriate way to make good use of this benefaction. And indeed, there's been a long string of very distinguished guests that we've had talk to us about matters Greek. Mr. Corbett was actually a mathematician. He wasn't a classicist, apparently. And he spent his career teaching in a sequence of schools, the last of which was Camford School near Wimborne in Dorset. And I have here, I think, an extract somewhere, if I can find it, from the old Camfordian, or the Camfordian, where the headmaster pays a special tribute of thanks to Mr. Corbett for his mathematical teaching is gaining us a wide reputation and making all the difference to the boy who, but for him, would have to sacrifice a school career for a coaching establishment. So that's... We don't know why he had this love of Greek, but we're very grateful that he did. As I say, he was a Christ man, and so indeed is our lecturer this evening, Michael Clark, who held the research fellowship at Christ back in the 90s. Michael graduated from University of Dublin and then Oxford, and had positions at Manchester and at Maynooth after Cambridge. He moved to Galway, where he's now professor of classics, in 1987. Michael works, he doesn't really work in any in a kind of regular field. He's a boundary crosser. I hope that his time in Cambridge, as it were, helped with the boundary crossing. So he works in historical linguistics and other kinds of linguistics that I'm not quite so familiar with. And above all, Homer and the Epic. His first book was a remarkable book, Flesh and Spirit in the Songs of Homer, because it's both an attempt really to understand Homer's view of humanity and the gods and the world and everything, and also Homeric vocabulary and how that works, and how you can't really understand either apart from the other. When I was young, it was quite an influential book by Bruno Snell, or actually it was an article really, by Bruno Snell. And Michael in the book says he advanced the theory that Homer has no unified concept of man's mental identity, that the entities in the Thumos family represented jumbled fragments of mental life that do not add up to a psychic whole. Michael is very delicate about how he expresses disagreement with this view, but we're all very relieved that he is one of those who made us give up if we ever entertained that supposition about Homer. And the end of that particular chapter says, well, what we've now seen is that that in Homeric man we find a continuum in which the sources and process of his mental life are inseparably united with the substance of what we nowadays call the body. In other words, we have a holistic view, I think is probably what most of us think about Home now. I know that Home is perfectly capable of thinking about human beings as human beings. But, of course, with a rich vocabulary and a rich range of registers that are quite different from that. Michael, particularly since he returned to Ireland, has got very interested in Irish and other insular epic, and not least in the reception of Homer, how Homer is received. And he was telling me at lunch about the various manuscripts he's been looking at for this tradition. He said, not many people work on this. I said, how many do? And he said, well, there's three others besides me. So we're very privileged to have Michael come and give us a taste of the work he's been doing, as it were, seeing Homer both in his, as it were, from the Homeric perspective and also from the medieval perspective. So I invite you to greet tonight's lecture.
Thank you very much, Malcolm, and thank you very much for coming. It's very nice to be here again. I want to talk about the word foundational to begin with. It's the custom that Homeric poetry gets foundational status, not just because it's so ancient, but because it feels like a primeval monument of European literature. And as such, it has an authority beyond that of any one poetic voice. Now, reception studies makes it easier these days to follow this line. And on your handout number one, I have a quote from Edith Hall for a typical mainstream view. The Homeric poems, she says, began to be charter texts at the moment when they were inscribed in phonetic script. Their importance as the possession of Greek speakers everywhere was recognized immediately. Knowledge of them became a passport into a psychological community spread over countless coasts and islands. Just for a moment, it sounds a little bit like on first looking into Chapman's Homer, which may be significant. Now, Edith Hall implies a dictation model of oral composition here. First, there's composition and performance, and that's separated by a gap from subsequent transmission through books or rhapsodes. Barry Powell famously has an extreme version of that model on the go. And I think that if you do your Death of the Author more openly than that, you can treat the name Homer as a myth, a traditional bardic function rather than an individual, as Nash puts it. So Homer ceases to be a real person, like Aeschylus bald or Sophocles with a weakness for very young boys. And pushing it backwards, you can follow the hints in the ancient lives of Homer, treat Homer as a founder hero, someone whose father was a daimon who consorted with the Muses, or turn to Plato's Ion at number two. And taking the famous image of magnets transmitting their power in successive metal rings, the man in the audience is the last of these rings, which take their power from each other under the influence of the magnetic stone. You, the rhapsode, and the actor are in the middle, and the first is the poet himself, and the god through all of these draws the soul of men in whichever direction he wishes. Now, if you take a non-ironic kernel out of that, the poet is just a conduit. One way to put it is that the real author is the muse. The muse is the daughter of calling to mind, which sounds like a personification of orally transmitted memory. Now, so far that is conventional. Homer famously doesn't represent his voice as his own. Muse, sing to me, he begins, where the likes of Virgil say arma verumque cano, and you can plot it as a kind of development. The cyclic epigonoi begins, let us begin, O muse, like Hesiod does. At number four there, you see the famous bit of poetry from the schoolroom on the Durus Cup, about 490 BC, where it looks as if the student has written out a hexameter which is kind of shifting from muse poetry towards poet as agent. Musa moi amphiscamondron euro on archomai aeden. He seems to start with an address to the muse, and then it becomes eye-centered at the end of the line. It sort of scans, but I don't think it works pragmatically. Now, that I noticed that actually that Barry Powell doesn't take it that way. He thinks he takes it at face value. He thinks it's right. I'm not sure it's an error, but you see my point, that sense of an intermediate. Now, in practice, when we go behind the name Homer, we use a set of labels that work like virtual synonyms. And they can be laid out, as at number five, in what Gowers, in The Complete Plain Words, called a buzz phrase generator, where you make a credible high-sounding phrase by picking any one item from each of the columns. So traditional, formulaic, epic, primary, bardic, poetry, oral, saga. It sort of works. Interestingly, one way out of this is to use the Greek word aoide as a label for that kind of poetry. Hainsworth does that, for example. I think this grid is kind of hiding behind that word, because from a Greek perspective, aoide is what Pindar or a nightingale does just as much as Homer. But in any case, the poet conjured up by the buzz phrases has certain precise characteristics over and above the fact that he's so very oral. He is the last of his kind. His tradition leaves its dying gasp in the transcription of his songs that underlies the text. And because his voice or his identity is collective rather than individual, he's very like the great being that used to be posited as the creator of traditional or folk tales. So that in a collection of folk tales, the individual who actually told the stories to the folklorist seldom even gets his name mentioned, and certainly not on the spine. Now, the image of this, I'll call him this bardic guy, can be seen crystallising between about 1730 and 1830, the years, I suppose, when the models of literary nationalism that still define our curricula were being invented. But just like Macpherson presents Ossian as the last remnant of the Scottish bards, just as in Ireland at the same decade, the blind poet Carolan was described on his tombstone as the last of the harpers. Well, how did his patroness know that if he'd only just died? It goes back. Beowulf, in its turn, is set up as the last breath of another tradition of oral heroic epic. If the Beowulf poet had a name and a date, no matter what it was, I don't believe he would ever have won that status. Being anonymous, being seeming like part of a national tradition, that's what sets you up in this way. Now there you have Celtic and Germanic antiquity asserting their dignity in parallel with the classical centre. So it's part of the birth of nationalism. Every nation needs a Homer. But this tide of cultural assertion washes back to the centre again in its turn. Now take a look at number six on the handout. This is Percy in the preface to his Relics of English Poetry, directly answering Macpherson a few years later and engendering the whole idea of the English ballad that goes at the front of anthologies. The minstrels, he says, that's his word, were an order of men who subsisted by the arts of poetry and music, and this is number six, and sang to the harp verses composed by themselves or others, always stringed instruments. The minstrels seem to have been the successors of the ancient bards, who under different names were admired and revered from the earliest ages by almost all the first inhabitants of Europe. Their skill was considered as something divine, their persons were deemed sacred, their attendance was solicited by kings, they were honored, loaded with honors and rewards. But the Saxons, soon after their establishment in this island, were converted to Christianity, and in proportion as literature, which must there mean literacy in our phase of the language, in proportion as literature prevailed among them, this rude admiration would begin to abate. And he talks about how the poet and the minstrel became different persons. Now, the model there is eerily like the model that Parry was later to apply to what he found in Yugoslavia. When you hear the Yugoslav bard sing his songs, you have the unmistakable impression that you're listening to Homer. Those are his words. Now, this ancient order, this last remnant of an oral tradition, is going to disappear as soon as literacy comes. It's saved at the last moment by the representative of literate civilization who ensures that a single copy is preserved in writing. And that is so strong in Percy, this black letter manuscript that he has and these fragments of manuscripts that ladies find being used by ignorant cowherds. To make straw in sheds. That's what he talks about in the introductions to various of the poems he collects. What I'm getting at here is that the circularity is the killer. And the word bard, why is the word bard always so comforting here? In Irish or Gaelic, it was never a normal term for a high epic poet. It indicates a lower grade in the poetic hierarchy. And it comes into English, this word bard, through the scholarship of early modern intellectuals like Spencer and Camden, spinning out stray remnants of British antiquity, basing themselves ultimately on the stuff about northern barbarians originating, I suppose, with Posidonius. You find it in Lucan, he talks about the bards, and Ammianus Marcellinus at number 7 there on the handout. Where the parallel with Homer is already explicit. The bards sang them with the sweet modulations of the lyre. Heroicis composita versibus. You see, the parallel that's been created with Homer is explicit there. Now, clearly underlying this model is that sense of mapping the growth of literature onto the growth of a child. From unself-conscious innocence towards mature self-awareness, so literary subjectivity comes later in this model. You can see such a curious reflection of this in the way that handbooks use Indo-European comparison for epic poetry. The orchid in the garden is, of course, Kleos Aphthaton in the Iliad, paralleling Shrava Akshitan in Vedic. Now, the trouble is that Kleos Aphthaton also occurs in very early verse inscriptions, where it is the fame that the dedicator will get from the gods for putting up the monument. That parallels the Vedic attestations of Shrava Akshitan far more closely than the line in Iliad 9 does. Thematically, contextually. But nobody ever talks about Indo-European subjective religious lyric, which is what the parallel points to far more closely than it does to Indo-European narrative epic. Now, the problem with this depersonalization is that even within Homeric poetry, the first personal pronoun is there. But apart from the proems, it only really appears when Homer says that he's unable to achieve something. Usually a combination of various themes, a marshalling of lots of knowledge. Take a look at number 8, the famous passage at the beginning of the Catalogue of Ships. I could not speak of or name the members of the host, not if they were 10 tongues, 10 mouths in me, an unbreakable voice, and so on. It's famous. Again, a less well-known but more revealing passage at number 9. The battle is getting very complicated in Iliad 12. And the poet says, Argale on dimetaute the on hos plant agoroisai. It's difficult for me to speak out all these things like a god. That's where me is. So the I is present. But a sense of the poet as agent doesn't fit into our conventional models. And that's the problem. Now, the hallmark of depersonalized folk poetry, and there's obviously the scare quotes tick in the air when I say that, but familiarized with that, the hallmark of this depersonalized poetry is a kind of lean primeval solemnity, the opposite of everything decadent, everything arch, everything paradoxical. Traditions don't do jokes, individuals do jokes. Which is where I come to the first text that I want to highlight today. It's your number 10. Am I getting the numbers right, by the way? Yeah, good. Hector is about to face Ajax in a duel, and he makes the familiar courtly agreement that the victor will ensure that the vanquished is given due honour in death. So, I'll return your body. And someday, one even of late-born men will say, sailing in his many-tongued ship over the wine-faced sea, this is the grave marker of a man who died long ago, whom once glorious Hector killed, when that man was doing great deeds, Aristoionta. Now, I used the word courtly deliberately earlier because it is so easy to miss the twist in what Hector says. Grave markers provide fame and glory, but here the fame will not be that of the man commemorated. He will be nameless. Hector is the one whose name will never die. So this is not courteous, it's a vicious dig. Now, the Bisgolia note this. Hector is described as philotimos kai aladzon kai barbara ethos. But if it's easy for us, with our sense of, you know, epic norms, heroic convention, if it's easy for us to miss that, we're in good company, because if you trust Aulus Gellius, Cicero misrendered the passage in his De Gloria. That's the next item there that I've left in Latin. According to Aulus Gellius, Cicero read the passage as if Ajax were the one speaking, in which case the sentiment would obviously be noble and generous. Leofrank points out in his book that this is the one mistake in Cicero that Gellius admits, and even there he suggests that Tyro really was to blame for it. But such is the fate of the number two. In its small way, that story gives us a clue to the fate of Homeric reading. We picture the shapes of a primeval past, the past of Flaxman's draftsmanship, the lean line, or Cicero's primeval Romans singing the deeds of their ancestors at their feasts. And we dissociate Homer from everything quirky and ironic, from everything you could call a Ladsonea. And yet, how can we be confident that we've reconstructed Hector's discourse correctly? Now, our problem is the problem of interpreting Homer out of Homer. It's the same as what's faced by a non-native speaker of English trying to learn how to learn conversational English from watching old Humphrey Bogart movies. To understand the irony, you have to be able to reconstruct the unmarked straight discourse that it plays on. So where do we go? Now, the passage invites comparison with verse epitaphs, and at number 12 there, you have a fine example from Corsair about 600 BC, where it's formulaically it's so similar, it's really tempting to see the Hector passage as based on epitaphs rather than the other way around, but that's another matter. He died when he was Aristoionta in the battle where there was much groaning. So if you surmise that the epitaph represents the basic, unmarked phrasebook sentiment, eternal fame for the one who was Aristoion, you might get a glimpse of the logic that Homer subverts, but of course it's difficult because that's a bit later than the posited date of composition, and all the time we have this sense that the Homeric worldview is different from that of real-life men, the kind of man whose relative is commemorated by that epitaph. Different either because it's more archaic or because that worldview is peculiar to the half-remembered, half-invented ethical and ideological world in which Homer's people move. Now, that is the, for me at least, the central problem of Homeric interpretation. When you try to contextualize, you seem to reach away from the rest of what comes to us from ancient Greece and towards a poetic construct that whose cultural reference seems to point to the closest thing to Homer in the heroic poetry of other parallel traditions. The place where you will find, where people have always found things that recall Homer, is in other constructed heroic ages. Now, this kind of thing was at its height around 1900, but it's left some marvellous monuments of scholarship, and in the history of comparative epic studies, there is nothing more compelling than the passage in The Heroic Age of 1912, where Chadwick sets out the passage of the Iliad that I've quoted. He sets out Hector's words alongside the passage where Beowulf tells his followers where he wants to be buried, at handout number 13. I'll give you Michael Alexander's translation. I think his run beautifully. Bid men of battle build me a tomb, fair after fire, on the foreland by the sea. There it is. It's over the sea. That shall stand as a reminder to me of my people, towering high over Hrona's nest, so that ocean travellers, that's the guy on the wine-faced sea, shall afterwards name it Beowulf's Barrow. Now, your man wasn't reading Homer. There's no other obvious intertext available. I will talk later about a passage in Aeneid 6 that might be relevant here. But there is no more compelling explanation still than Chadwick's one of the resemblance. Parallel cultural values have produced parallel images. And at the next item on the handout, I just give you another example from the western side of the Irish Sea, from about the same time as Beowulf was composed. The poem of Whale Murray of Fohan about Irish origins, and he's recounting the invasion of the sons of Meal at Inniviskeana near Kenmare, and he describes how Dun, who may or may not be a death god in origin, died by shipwreck as they arrived. Dun went with the other half in progressive order. He died travelling without power. He died travelling without power at the south of Iris. A cairn was raised for him with the stone of his people over the broad sea. It's always over the broad sea that the monument is raised. Now, it's very enticing, this kind of thing, and it works. But if you inquire a bit more closely, if you ask exactly why Beowulf and Homeric epic can be classed in a mutually reinforcing unity called traditional oral epic, it seems to be precisely because of that categorization as collective, national, oral, and public. Both poems seem to represent a tradition where the identity of the poet is that of the order to which he belongs, and within the poem, in each tradition, there is a poet of exactly that kind. Phemius or Demodocus in the Odyssey, or in Heorot the Scope, who's like Caedmon, the herdsman inspired by the god to sing without the art of writing. So there's a closed circle here. Orality, blindness, and inspiration from divine instruction. And I emphasize blindness here because I think that's the key thing that gives shape to this sense of collective identity. Just as the prophet is blind, Oedipus achieving true knowledge, you know, that's linked to putting his eyes out, so the true knowledge that the poet has comes from the god who's robbed him of his eyes and compensated him with the gift of all the paths of song. So, spinning it, Stesichorus is cited when he insults Helen, and with blindness comes the true poetic insight of the Palinode. Now that is chat about blindness, okay? But what I really want to talk about is the curious fact that for most of the history of epic heroic tradition in the West, the direct influence of Homeric poetry has been an awful lot less than it seems in a world where E.V. Rieu is a bestseller. And the succession of magnetic rings was broken very early on. In what we used to call the Middle Ages, and even in the early print era, the true carrier of the heroic tradition in the West was someone who stands as the direct opposite to Homer. the opposite, because he's all about sight. He was there. He saw the war with his own eyes and wrote it up in language so plain and austere that it sounds like Caesar's Gallic Wars on a bad day. Deliberately so. And I mean Diarius Phrygius. Now, if the number of Toggletree punters in the world is small, I suspect that the number of Diaries enthusiasts is even smaller. But I think their loss is all the greater, or perhaps our loss is all the greater. Diaries is a character in the Iliad. I think we may never know why he was picked on by the author of this crazy text. There was a certain Diaries amongst the Trojans, wealthy and blameless, and so on. Diaries was there. The text explains that he was there. He wrote down what he had seen, the Acta Diurna, which is then translated into Latin at some stage and becomes the basis of the medieval tradition about what actually happened in the Trojan War. Now, Diaries is a brief, bold text. At number 19 there on your handout, I'm skipping a little bit, at number 19 on your handout, you have perhaps the most revealing passage from Diaries. He, at point, the first one, 19a there, he specifies exactly how he got to see all this stuff and mentions, when he's going to describe Castor and Pollux, who of course weren't there, he says he heard this from the Trojans, a Diardanes Odyssey. So it's all about sight, accuracy. And the lists of adjectives that he gathers to describe what they look like. Hectorem, blaesum, candidum, crispum, strabonem, pernicibus membris, vultu venerabile, barbatum, decentem, and so on. And Helen of Troy had a beauty spot thing just there. And not only does he tell you the real name of Briseis's daughter and Chryseis's daughter, he also mentions that Briseis's daughter had joined eyebrows. Right, he had supercilious junctis because he was there. Now, obviously, he wasn't. Obviously, it's a fraud, is probably a mistake. This probably comes from the second sophistic period, with that emphasis on cleverness, sight, and the faking of eyewitness accounts. Just today, as luck would have it, I came across this excellent new book by Lawrence Kim, Homer Between History and Fiction in Imperial Greek Literature, where he makes exactly that point. The fraud, the fiction that pseudo-diaries sets up is so like what Lucian does in the Vera Historia. Kim talks about the Heroicus of Philostratus, where there's all this stuff about sight and accuracy and actually seeing what went on in the Trojan War. And it also recalls for me, in a broader way, the younger Philostratus, the Imaginate, that emphasis on sight and image and putting picture before the eyes. But we can only speculate about, you know, the possible Greek exemplar behind Diaries. The point is that for Isidore, the great encyclopedist of Western Christendom, he is the first pagan historian precisely because he saw what happened. That's your number 17. Amongst the ancients, says Isidore, nobody wrote a historia except the one who had actually been present and seen the things worth writing down. We grasp better what happens with our eyes than what we gather through hearing. What is seen is brought forth without deceit. So Moses wrote the first historia for us, and amongst the pagans, Diaries Phrygius produced the first historia, which was written by him on palm leaves. That is probably a mistranslation of a Greek original. The other text by Dictys of Crete, which, as we'll see, merges with Diaries, was originally written in Phoenician letters, according to the introductory letter. And I think the word phoenikos, has got mixed up there in the translation. Now, Diaries is a Trojan. He sees it from the Trojan point of view. The other much longer text that comes into play is Dictys of Crete, probably originating as part of the same literary joke, if you like, in the same period, but seeing it from a Greek point of view. Now, in the subsequent tradition, the two get merged Diaries provides the skeleton, Dictus provides many of the details. So the Troy legend, as it develops in the Middle Ages, is rather like a bargain basement version of the way Collingwood describes Thucydides, taking all these eyewitness accounts and becoming the autobiographer of his generation. Something like that is created when they're brought together. Elsewhere in Isidore at number 18, you have another insight into this thing about really seeing it, where he says some poets are called, well, I say theologists, because they made poems about gods. The function of poets is this, to transform things that have taken place into other forms, modified and so on. Whence Lucan, on that account, is not placed amongst the number of poets because he seems to have composed historiae, not a poem. Lucan, of course, excludes the gods from the action. Diaries appealed to the later mind because there are no gods in diaries. There's no artifice. There's nothing that looks like a poetic fiction. It's the truth. Now, Diaries, Dictus, and a mysterious further text, the Excidium Troiae, become the ingredients of the Trojan story as it made its way through the new nations of the medieval north. There are so many of them. Trojamanna saga in Iceland. There's an Irish one, which we'll hear about in a few minutes. The French Roman de Troyes by Benoit. Joseph of Exeter's Latin poem, which I'll talk about in a few minutes, and so on. They all spread out from this initial mix, and Diaries always provides the skeleton. Diaries, of course, being a Trojan, becomes a way of setting up the Trojan story as a foundation legend for the new nations of Northern Europe. So, for example, in one of the Merovingian chronicles of France, there is Diretus Phrygii Historia about the origin of the Franks. And he must have obviously lived quite a long time to know exactly what happened to Francio after he left the war. But the point is, of course, that the name is like a seal at the beginning of the story. It gives it authority. Now, it trickles down like that. I was looking recently at the beautiful survival from a late 15th century tapestry series on the Trojan War, recently gone on display, restored in the Victorian Albert. It's on the handout. I think it's in full colour, which is great. It's an absolutely beautiful thing, and the names of Diaries and Dictus are actually mentioned in the inscriptions at the bottom of one of the other tapestries in that series. Now, my own concern with Diaries dates from the time when I realised about 10 years ago that I couldn't cross Dublin without passing a manuscript, usually unpublished, of the little studied Irish version, Tuggle Tree. Now this other, quite separate witness to the Diaries tradition comes to us in a series of versions, maybe from as early as the 10th century onwards, certainly the 11th. And it takes Diaries' bold narrative, seemingly without interference from the other built-up poetic narratives, or built-up, you know, established vernacular narratives that I've talked about. It takes Diaries' bold original and builds it up into the shapes that are familiar from the much more famous sagas dealing with native Irish heroic subject matter. Now, in the Irish canon, the two strands of subject matter form a single genre, a classical narrative clad in Irish style and an Irish narrative, the famous Tom Bulcullin and others, which reach towards the status of classicising history or pseudo-history, so that the Trojan War becomes part of the Irish worldview and the cattle raid of Cooley becomes part of the world history in which Ireland belongs. Now, the third recension, so-called third recension of this text, is where my own research is focused now. At number 20, I just have an image there of one of the later manuscripts of Tuggle Tree from the Book of Ballymote, the text about 1390. The text grows. It grows in depth and it grows in complexity as it goes on. Brent Miles, who has been working on the sources of Tuggle Tree for many years, is about to publish a monograph about this from Boydell and Brewer in a few months' time, which will be very important. And some of what I have to say is drawn from Brent's observations. Now, the way the narrative is built up includes expansions that seem very obviously Irish. The bird-like battle deities, familiar from Irish saga, replace the Greek furies. similes become purple patches, if you like, of the kind familiar throughout Irish narrative. As I've argued in another paper, there is a warp spasm of Troilus, who goes to frenzy in war and becomes sort of divine or demonic. It corresponds exactly to a parallel description of Cuchulainn in Tán Bó Cualnna, not because the one is imitating the other, but because they're mirroring and reinforcing each other. Troilus becomes our Cuchulainn and vice versa, a point that was picked up on by a praise poet in the 12th century. But more important for our purposes today, there are expansions that seem almost stage Irish as well. Drawing on, it's not clear what source, possibly the Excidium Troiae, the third text, the joker in the pack, if you like, the narrator of Toggle Tree tells the story of the wedding feast of Peleus and Thetis. He has details that occur elsewhere in Servius and in the First Vatican Lithographer and so on, but he also says that the reason Discord wasn't invited to the wedding feast was because she couldn't hold her drink. And there is something very knowing about the way the Irish language is being used, is inscribing itself into international tales at the same time as the same literati are doing the reverse, doing the mirror image of that. Now, the thing is that you also see things that are uncannily classical. Uncannily, because the author seems to be drawing the narrative further and further away from the pseudo-autopsy of diaries and towards a Homeric register and Homeric content. Now, I'll take you an example here, that first one that puzzled me very much until I think Brent Miles solved it. Towards the beginning of the main Trojan War, there is a catalogue passage, a description of all the different contingents of the Greeks. And it's focalised in a messenger speech. The messenger comes back to Priam. It's kind of a riddling messenger speech. I've written about it before. But when he's talking about all the different contingents, he says, it's at number 21 there, "Though indeed there were seven tongues in the head of each of us," said they, "we would not be able to give the description of everyone that we saw." Now, that fits, of course, the Homeric passage at the beginning of the catalogue of ships, the bit about the tongues. I couldn't do it. It fits exactly. It's not in diaries. It's not in dictus. How does it get there? How does it get into the right place? Now, in this case, you can spot how the reinsertion has been made. Miles has shown that Macrobius, and there is good evidence for knowledge of Macrobius in insular circles, he quotes as follows at number 22 on your handout: "Homeri est, ude moi decem in glossa," etc., etc. So what we imagine is that our literateur is taking his narrative as he finds it, and he has the learning, the atomistic learning, based perhaps on Macrobius and certainly on some parallel intertext, he has the knowledge to fit things in this case in the right context. So it's kind of a Homer, a sort of a Homer coming back from the grave here. Now, it can be much trickier than this, and I will give you my favourite example. Diaries talks about how Achilles did battle with the Moesians and wounded Teuthras, their king. Bald, simple account in diaries. At 23, you have the account from the first recension of Toggle 3. Then Achilles came through the host of Mysians like a fiercely wounding lion worried on account of its cubs, or like a furious bull to which an evil blow has been given. Now, in an earlier paper that I published on this in that book, Epic Interactions, that Malcolm has there, I pointed out the weird resemblance to the famous simile in Iliad 16. Peleus' son began the close-packed lamentation, groaning deeply like a lion born to strength, whose cubs a deer-hunting man has stolen from out of the dense wood, and the lion comes after him in anger. Has the author of Toggle Tree somehow assimilated this simile out of Homer and reapplied it to the correct hero? is there room for an article on the Irish reception of Gilgamesh? Because that's where the simile ultimately comes from. Now, the answer is stranger in a way. After publishing on that first, I found the same words in a simile in the Irish prose translation of Statius's Thebaid, which is attested from a couple of centuries later than Tuggle Tree, but belongs very much in the same genre. You have it at number 25. He turned in this way upon the hosts like a lion full of anger whom warriors attack when he's vexed on account of his cubs. And the words in Irish are so closely similar that it couldn't be coincidence. And I've given you Statius's original at 26, which of course is ultimately based on Homer. Now, it seems to me irresistible to conclude that the author of Toggle 3 lifted the simile from a now lost early version of Toggle the Teba, or something like that must have happened, in which case the chain of transmission runs from the Iliad to Statius to the Irish Toggle the Teba in a proto version to our Toggle 3. It's an extraordinary roundabout transmission. Now, is it a coincidence, or more than a coincidence, that the simile has found its way back to Achilles? Because, of course, Statius is talking about somebody else. Lactantius Placidus's commentary on Statius doesn't mention that. That's most likely the scholiastic source that you'd look to. Is it a coincidence? I can only speculate. I still suspect it's more than that. Now, that's where I take the image I put in my title of the flesh and bones of epic tradition. After the death of Homer, so to speak, the bit where the magnetic rings run out, the bones remain in the form of Darius's lean history. And new flesh was put on them in the different environments where Darius was received and became part of canonical historiography. In Ireland, the flesh came from endless scraps and fragments of lore and commonplace imagery, some of which, from our point of view, is Irish, some classical, but in context, they are moulded into a new unity. And to return to the problem that I've tried to highlight, there are no jokes and no irony in Darius. That's how he resembles the mythical folk poet that we tend to have as a ghost behind Homer. Now, as the Toggle Tree tradition and the Irish narratives develop side by side with each other, Irish pseudo-history gets laden with classicising elements, some obvious, some less so, some are hidden. This is a general point about Middle Irish narrative. The author of another of our texts, Fingal Ronan, disguises the Hippolytus story out of Seneca and makes it into the story of a prince of Leinster with a seductive stepmother. Things like that happen throughout medieval Irish king tales especially. Now, there's a fine example of this classicising tendency in Irish heroic narrative on native themes in the famous Tán Bó Cualainne, in a passage that in the 19th century became Ireland's answer to Dulce et Decorum est pro patria mori. It's when the boy hero Cuchulainn overhears the druid saying that it's a good day to take up arms. It's at number 27. It is indeed a day of good omen, said Cathfoot, as the druid. It is certain that he who takes up arms today will be famous and renowned, but he will, however, be short-lived. A mighty thing, said Cuchulainn, provided I be famous, I am content to be only one day on earth. And he's then given one set of weapons after another and smashes them all until the best is found. Now, this has been quoted so many times as a perfect cross-cultural parallel to the choice of Achilles in the Iliad. My mother, silver-footed Thetis, tells me that two death spirits are drawing me towards the end of death. Perfect if you want to set up a Celtic and a Greek heroic cycle as parallel developments in different cultural worlds. But, as Brent Miles shows, if you were the author of that text and you had Servius in front of you, and they undoubtedly did have something like Servius Danielis in front of them, then you could have been recreating the Achilles image in Irish guise, and it's there at number 28, the passage from Servius. Achilles recalls in Homer how his mother says to him, and so on, that if he leaves the Trojan War, goes home, he lived fine old age without glory, but if he keeps on fighting at Troy, he will get the great glory and die young. Works perfectly. if you say that Servius's account has gone into the mix and has become is the back text behind that passage of Ton Poculinum. But look at Servius again and you see what's lost compared with Homer. In Homer, of course, when Achilles announces that prophecy, he's rejecting heroism and leaving the war. I'm going home tomorrow to Phthia. And if the Iliad centers around these lines, it's because the central hero is stepping outside the heroic world, distancing himself from it, rejecting it. Just like you can, if you want, push it to say that the triumphant Odysseus of the Odyssey has to become a naked every man before he returns to light and life and so on. Thematically, it's the rejection in the Iliad that provides the poetry. But when Servius is the conduit, the irony and the nuance are lost. Servius doesn't, of course, mention that Achilles is rejecting the choice of glory. And if you just read Servius Danielis, you would assume that Achilles, the great glorious hero, is going to take the early death and the great glory, just like Cuchulainn does. Now, one's first reaction to this kind of thing can be disappointment. You get endless contamination in place of the discrete cultural purities that, either we were brought up with or our teachers that we admired so much were brought up with. Instead, I suggest that the lesson can be put in very positive terms. There is a universal behind these different heroising traditions. These different literatures all seek origins and look backward. Homer was always archaic, and I wonder if the Semnotes of Sophocles at Ajax originally seemed like a backward-looking view of the world, not just an inflexibly martial one. And the abiding principle behind all the medieval traditions here is their sense of a universal humanity in the remote past. The further back you look, the more different modern nations in their origins seem the same. And this, at least, is implicit throughout the Irish texts I've been quoting. Now, there are hints in the same direction in the quite different flesh that Joseph of Exeter put on Dyre's account at exactly the same time that the Irish were creating Tumble Three in the Book of Leinster and Benoit was spinning the Roman. Joseph of Exeter is full of austere rhetoric, very lean on visual richness, but he has the odd moment. Like when he talks about how people looked in vain for Castor and Pollux after they had disappeared and started treating them like gods instead, and that's at number 22. They found them not among the Trojans nor in the midst of the waves, so they believed them to be gods. Turned back with useless devotion, they increased their cities with gods, their altars with incense, their temples with marble. Just so does the laughable trust and gullible error of the Britons wait for Arthur, and we'll wait forever. That's the end of book three. It just has a twist of contemporary reference. And here in a small way, you can see how this archaizing thing, the Troy tale, is becoming part of a universal set of heroic cycles. Troy, Arthur, Alexander, Charlemagne. And in this case, the ideology of ancient chivalry is being built on it. Now, I offer these examples at least as a sense of the surprises that await you when you push your definition of classical literature further than we used to, in this case further forward in time and further north in space. But this set of texts has something more profound to teach us as well. Texts like Toggle 3 force us to read Homer in a new way and to reassess the mental apparatus that we use to make sense of Homeric values and imagery. Now, deep in this high Victorian construction of Hellenism is an ethnographic urge to make sense of Homer, always comparing it with other primal cultures. When I was 10, I had a copy of Andrew Lang's Homer in the Epic, and I remember the frontispiece. It's a picture of Algonquin warriors doing hand-to-hand combat in upstate New York in the 17th century. Such a statement, an exciting statement. Is it completely false? I don't know, but I do know that if I'd come in here and gone on about cross-cultural parallels between Greek and Celtic heroic ages, I probably would have got away with it. Or at least there are university towns in the southern half of England where I would have got away with it. But this is time for something new. What I am urging here is a post-colonial reading of Homer, in the most interesting sense of the word post-colonialism. If our forebears put Greek classicism at the centre and reached out to a cultural periphery, like Dodds and the Greeks and the Irrational. Dodds is from Banbridge, County Down. He talks about my superstitious countrymen, the Irish, but he also talks about links with Borneo and the primitive past. And he means Levi Brule. It's extraordinary. But that's what used to be done. And the tables are now turned, and the voice from the periphery turns back towards the centre. Now, the last literati to produce versions of Togal Tree in the 1490s, roughly, were contemporary with Chapman, contemporary with the generation that was reclaiming Homer's unmediated poetic voice as part of Tudor and Jacobean culture and indeed empire. And I don't doubt that those literati knew that their tradition was on the run, that it was becoming marginal and archaic in the new Europe. And where Chapman reaches back to the past across an unbridgeable gulf, and he wrestles to replace the pseudo-historical tradition with the unmediated voice of Homer, the authors of Togal Tree were doing something complementary. They were at the last stage of a sequence of creation and recreation that was never broken as long as it lasted, and it stretches right back into late antiquity itself. We hear so much about classical receptions these days. I suggest that it's time to reclaim the vitality of classical continuities. Thank you very much.
Well, catch your breath. We've had a wonderful voyage, which I think my words about boundary crossing have been confirmed many times over in many different dimensions by Michael's lecture this evening, as we've moved from Homer and thinking about bards and the function of the idea of the bard and the national tradition through authors in what used to be called the Dark Age, of whom some of us, I suppose, were barely aware, and some of which we weren't aware at all, into the Irish context that Michael is now very much making his own, and that every other minute we had some stimulating thought, something coming from left field that took us by surprise. And so it's been an enormously rich and amusing and playful experience. Thank you very much.